Before you begin, question. You'll be showing images from the computer? Okay. So we need someone who can take notes on the post-it boards. Can someone help us with that? Tim? Fantastic.
Yeah, sorry. Oh, but I need a microphone. Okay. Well, no, it's just...
Hello?
No, I was just thinking of, for the first time in all these years, there is another way to interpret in sound artists, and you just clicked today that it's also correct, firm, solid. And I think for me it's important because from the time that we've been talking about what does it mean to be a community organizer versus an activist, I've taken a very orthodox or very dogmatic attitude that really organizer is more important and better than being an activist. Because to be an organizer, you have to be inserted in a community. To be an activist, you float from issue to issue, you float from community to community, you're not accountable. You do your thing and you move on, regardless of whether the impact is there or not. But when you're an organizer, first of all, you have to be connected to a community. Second of all, you deal with the consequences of what you do. And third, you'll have to live with the results. In the work that I've done in East LA, I've lived in Boyle Heights since I moved to Los Angeles. And I've been part of that community since I've been here. And in that process, I've engaged in what now we would be calling militant sound investigations, in the sense that responding to Don's question, we're in a war, basically. Boyle Heights, for the last 15 to 20 years, has been the object of transformation. We're right next to downtown Los Angeles. And because we're right next to downtown Los Angeles, with one of the highest concentrations of poverty in Los Angeles, we are an obstacle, an ugly thing, something that has to be transformed and developed. And this started long, long time ago. You know, when from the moment that we were pushed from, the Latino community was pushed from downtown to the corners of East LA, up to now, it's Los Angeles is a problem. Boyle Heights, East LA is a problem. And I've been engaged in that in three levels, basically. The first one was as part of a church. We were doing what you call church-based communities. This is a byproduct of the process of liberation theology that got started in the 60s in Latin America, basically. And it was a way for a community to develop a voice, to become subjects of history. It was a place where people would sit down to talk about the relationship to God, but not as objects, but as subjects, as people who were engaging in this relationship with God, reproducing or creating in the Christian context was the kingdom of God, creating an ideal world, but from the point of departure of what the community was at. So when I started working in the projects in East LA in early 1980s, we were talking about a community that when you read the newspapers, you were talking about gang members, murder, drug dealing, police abuse, the worst kind of community that you can think of. But when we sat down and talked to the community, people were talking about their children, their neighbors, their life in Mexico, the community that they were living in. They were talking about a whole series of relationships that they had that had nothing to do with that reality that we read in newspapers, or nothing to do with the reality of the community developers or organizers or people that were working in that community. And our work at that time was basically to start from that big picture and say, okay, so what does it mean to be a community? And we started building communities. Small groups of people that would get together, talk about their everyday life, and celebrate the good, and talk about the problems and the obstacles, and then work together to make their ideals or these things more reality, more visible, and start organizing, basically. So we moved from having a voice to organizing to doing something. So in the case of the gangs, we were dealing with the notion that the gangs were the enemy. And when you would ask to some of the women about what the gangs were, they basically said, well, you know, they're criminals, hoodlums, they kill each other, they kill our children, they put ourselves in fear. But the more we had conversations about it, they started remembering, well, you know, we babysit those kids. Well, they're the friends of my son, but they hang around here and they really don't do anything to us, but they deal drugs. And we started developing some kind of interventions as community to address this stuff. And one of the interventions that we engaged with that started this process was basically organizing food gatherings, like barbecues, where the women and the mothers who lived in the neighborhood would get together and prepare food and then go to the gang member and offer him the food. And the funny thing would happen is that as they would get up and bring a taco or a torta to this guy, the guy would pick it up and run and hide somewhere else. And they would do this like one or three times a week. And eventually they started realizing that they were getting control of the space where the gang members were, that the gang members were scared, and really they were the ones who had control of this community. And in that process, they also developed familiarity once again, because they were moving from fear when they were just hiding from the gang members to familiarity and to relationship. All of a sudden they're saying, oh, these guys are shy, and I can go and talk to them, and I'm going to scare them. So it was a different kind of relationship little by little. And they moved from, whereas before they used to have the police being the person or the identity or the institution that would solve the solution, to being themselves the one who brought the solution. Whenever there was a gang member dealing drugs, they would just hang around next to him. And because he didn't want to sell drugs in front of her, he would go somewhere else to deal the drugs. And because another woman was part of that base community, she would hang around next to this guy, and he would have to go somewhere else. Eventually, the drug dealing spot became a floating thing throughout the neighborhood because they couldn't stand still in any place. And we didn't need the police to deal with it. We didn't need to beat them up or to do anything to deal with it. We were just managing it. And that's something that we learned in the process of working with the base communities. We were not about disappearing problems, we were about managing problems. The larger problems in the community are not intrinsic to the community, have more to do with capitalist relationships of power, have more to do with other kinds of powers and imbalances that are not created in that community, they're created outside of that community. And the community somehow is pushed to reproduce them, and what we needed to do was break away from them. Anyway, one problem with this kind of... So I was inserted, I was living in that community, but this community was... the organizers or the institution that was working within the community was a church. Most of the priests, actually all of the priests, were white. And they were really good priests, really good people. They were Jesuits. But at some point, when the next phase of development came, which was erasure of these projects, tearing down these projects, demolishing them, the white priests thought that that was a good thing. The poor are not meant to live together. The poor are not meant to live on top of each other. That's what one of the priests used to say. Therefore, this was a good thing. They had to accept it. They had to embrace it. So after years of working in this community, talking about God is with you, and the God of the oppressed marches with you, and the Virgin of Guadalupe blesses your fights, and you have to fight against all sorts of injustices, the priest turned it off and said, this is a good thing, and you have to accept it. So all of a sudden, the God, Christ, the church, the Guadalupe Virgin, everybody started blessing demolition and destruction, just like that. They were not inserted. They had no relationships with the community. They had no problem living with the consequences. They were going to move on. Every 6 years, the priests move on. And if they don't move on, they change jobs and they build up these large corporations. But in any case, when we were talking to the community was saying, this is not a good idea because actually I like living here. Actually, I like knowing the gang members that I work with. Actually, I like knowing that if there is a gang shooting, I can talk to my friends and warn them so we all can prevent the shooting. It came to a point in East LA, in the projects in Pico Aliso, where the mothers would, whenever they would know that there was going to be war, they would stand in the middle of the street just catching the gang members as they were trying to cross the borders. And the gang members, because they knew them, because they had received food from them, because they had been hanging around with them, basically we just hide their guns and walk away. They had learned to manage the problem. That doesn't happen anywhere else in Los Angeles. There isn't a single community in Los Angeles where that's happening right now. You have the middle of the night walks when the police escorts people to do this. You have these big publicity things. But there is not a community where people just, on their everyday life, when they know there is potential for crime, they just step out and just hang around. It's very rare to do that. But the housing authority of the city of Los Angeles was there to destroy it, and the church was there to bless it. And those who were inserted decided to fight against it. And that's how the Unión de Vecinos was formed. And but it was in the process of investigation with the community, what is it that you wanted to have? And in this investigation, basically, the first question was, do you want to move out? And they said no. And the second question is, well, what do you want to do? And the decision was, we're going to fight against it. And the third question is, well, how are we going to fight against it? Well, we're going to educate the rest of the neighbors. And basically, we had a long, protracted struggle to win this, where our members, the members of the Unión de Vecinos, gained a contract that they were guaranteeing them the staying in the development until the end of the project. I mean, forever, unless they decided to move out or unless they broke their contract, and then the housing authority would kick them out. But we won that battle, and we were able to stick to this community, and this community got to stick. In the next phase of the development, the housing authority said, oh, we're not going to do this. We're not going to open up the space for this. First, we're going to take everybody out. Then we're going to demolish everything. And they did. And one of the ways they did it is because they brought the police and started beating up. We had a small group of women that were involved in this process, and they got beaten up. And eventually, there was a state of fear in the community where people pretty much had to, we had to take a step back, and we had to live with the consequences of deciding not to engage in this battle. So we negotiated the relocation. And in the process of relocation, a lot of our leaders got to move in different parts of Boyle Heights. That's when the committees got started. And then we start asking the question, well, are we just about housing projects or are we about Boyle Heights? So we grew from being about the two housing projects to being about Boyle Heights. And we continue our process of investigation. And let me, hold on a second. So as I was saying, the war in East LA continues and has expanded. The first trigger point was the projects. But the highest concentration of poor people in East Los Angeles, we're about talking about 2,000 families, the largest project in west of the Mississippi. And we're talking about, so those families got spread throughout the neighborhood. And the question was, well, what are we going to do while all these plans for development are coming to East LA? When we finish this process, you can look at it more closely. But basically, what we have here is the 10 freeway, the 101 and the, I'm lying. This is the 101, and here is the 5. And down here is the 710, and here is the 60. So this is all of Boyle Heights. And basically, right now in downtown, there's a whole plan to improve all of the First Street Avenue corridor, which is right here, from the Disney Hall all the way to, I think, Montebello, basically. So joining the middle class of East Los Angeles with the corporate centers in downtown, and now the people who live in the lofts. How many of you live in the lofts in downtown, by the way? Nobody? Okay. I just wanted to know if I had some neighbors living here. But basically, the whole idea is to join those to middle class of Latino middle class with corporate downtown all across East LA through First Street or through Cesar Chavez Avenue, otherwise known as Brooklyn Avenue. And right here in the middle of in the southern part of the development, in Sears, they're going to build this large for-profit housing, 750 units. All for upper-income families. In the process of this development, they've been demolishing lots of housing. They demolished a housing, like 60 units of housing, to build housing to build a larger police station. They demolished about 200 to 300 houses to build the metro rail line. They developed 2,000 housing in the projects. All this section that's got demolished because they wanted to remove the poor people. But we have lots of housing coming to East LA, and none of it is for the community. They're building this corridor, these two corridors of transportation, and it's not about the community, because what we're seeing in Boyle Heights is that the traffic is just speeding up in the cars, and all the cross people who are walking through the street are being run over or being at risk of run over. So our battles right now in East LA are about putting a stop sign, slowing traffic, etc., etc. So if I'm inserted in the community, if I have a relationship with a community, if I'm an organizer, and if we have all these different committees, we have to do something to engage in a battle against this other force that is coming down here. And as we done this, this is an exercise that we've done. Basically, a couple of weeks ago, we sat down with the residents, and if you look at the, you can see from there, but there is these little dots around here, black dots, and this is where people live throughout the project. And then we asked them, well, where do you spend your money? And all these green dots are the places where they spend their money. And it's very interesting that here, in the corner of Cesar Chavez and Soto, is where the highest concentration of money is spent by the community. But they're developing First Street, and they're doing this large housing development here, and this corridor is just a pass-through thing. But most of people spend their money in this corridor, which is going to change. And after that, we told them, well, where do you get your education? Where do you engage in ideological, the reproduction, and basically the schools, the libraries, everything. And this, all these orange areas, which I don't remember what they mean anymore. Oh, no, these are the achievements. I'm sorry. I was asking, where are the achievements that you have had? And these are different battles. On this whole section, in Boyle Heights, as they're building the corridors, as the traffic has been built up, there was all these alleys where people didn't have enough light. And when you think of an alley, you think of the back of a house. Well, in East LA, the alleys usually are the front of the house in a lot of cases. People go to access their home through the alleys. Why? Because there's a lot of garages that have been adapted to become housing. Or because the owners who don't like a lot of times their tenants don't let them come through the front, so they have to go through the back. Anyway, so for us, the alleys was a place of safety. So we had a lot of victories around the alleys here in East LA. We had a lot of victories in paving the streets that were not the main streets that they're trying to work on. And we realized that we were lacking on achievements here. But really, downtown is developing from here to here and from here to here. So as we've been analyzing this picture in the community, we're seeing, the concentration of money that is coming from the outside is going somewhere else from where we spend the money. People want to gather, the developers want people to gather in places where we don't gather. And all we did was doing this map, where we were just asking people, where do you get together, where do you spend your money, where do you take your children to school, where do you get your education, where do you recreate yourself. So as an activist, you cannot do that. Or you can do that for 2 days, you move on, and the map stays there. If you're a sound artist in the sense of correctness, firmness, and stability, sorry, don't had to kill it. But if you're a sound artist in that sense, then you have to stick to it. You have to stick to it. We have to figure out how we're going to fight to make this map more of a reality. And we have to develop the allies in the community and turn our art piece and our process into a tool for change. It cannot just stay there to be exhibited. It cannot stay here today because we're taking it home to work with it. So that's for me what our militant sound activism, sound investigation is about. And that's what, for me, what the Unión de Vecinos and the work that we're doing as Ultra is about. Thank you.